You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
More than 50 years after Brown versus the Board of Education ruling to desegregate schools, a wide range of scholars are wondering how far we've actually come in providing educational equality. NYU professor Pedro Noguera has called his new book on the issue, The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race, Equity, and the Future of Public Education. I talked with him earlier this summer, and here it is again. I began by asking him if American public education was in serious crisis, racial considerations aside.
I always say crisis is a problematic term because crisis always implies temporary, doesn't it? You can't be in a permanent crisis. And the problems facing public schools in this country really are chronic and they're longstanding.
And worsening?
I don't know about that. I think I see lots of examples of schools that have really improved and districts. I think New York City has a number of schools that have improved.
But is this mostly an urban problem, or are we seeing similar issues in suburban and rural areas?
It's really a problem of poverty and of inequality. I mean, you can find great schools right here in New York or in Chicago or in Boston. You can also find really bad schools in places like Poughkeepsie or East St. Louis. That is, wherever you see large concentrations of poor kids, whatever, no matter what their color, you tend to find schools that are not very good.
And is this true all around the world, or is our approach to education different than other places?
Many other countries have this problem. Most advanced industrial democracies don't have this problem. We suffer more so than most of countries of Western Europe or Canada because we consistently give the least in the way of resources to the neediest kids and neediest schools.
Before we get to the problems, you mentioned that there are some success stories. Can you give us a couple of examples?
Sure. I could describe PS 188 right here on the Lower East Side off of Houston. It's a school that serves mostly kids from the projects right there. About 20% of the kids are homeless kids. It's a fairly high-performing school.
Why is that?
I think it's because of the leader Barbara Slayton, just an extraordinary leader who's been very good at getting resources in. She's, they keep the school open till midnight. They have an internet cafe for kids and for families. But it's really the philosophy. They really try to provide an enriched learning environment for kids, not focused narrowly on raising test scores. They want to make sure that kids get excited about learning. And it works, particularly when you bring in talented individuals to teach the kids.
Most of the scholars and academics who write about these things are teaching in college and have little firsthand knowledge, little hands-on knowledge. What about you?
Well, I've had a lot of firsthand knowledge of teaching directly into schools, and I continue to do that on a regular basis.
Despite being a professor at
Steinhardt? Because I think it's important that when you write about these issues, when you try to influence policy, as I often try to do, that you also know what's going on in schools. And my earliest teaching experiences were in schools for kids who've been kicked out of the traditional public schools in California. Where I saw kids who, many of whom have had, criminal records and very poor academic backgrounds, who, when we, again, really spent time thinking about who are those kids, what does it take to teach them, we could really draw on resources to figure out how to meet their needs. So I come to this as an optimist about what's possible.
Well, did you come through the New York public school system?
I did. I went to schools out in Brownsville. And then I went to schools in Queens. Then ultimately we moved to Long Island. My father was a police officer here in New York. So like many cops, wanted to get out of the city. So I ended up going to school out in Long Island.
And which ones were the best ones?
I've written elsewhere that I think, because neither of my parents graduated from high school. They sent all six of their kids to college. I've written that I think we succeeded in spite of school rather than because of. But I can think of several teachers along the way that were excellent and were highly influential for me.
Many people believe that the answer is simply imposing stricter standards on schools.
I'm for standards. I think we have to raise standards, and we've done that to some degree with No Child Left Behind, but by no means in ways that I think We need to, I think, for example, we need to make sure kids are learning foreign languages. We need to make sure that kids have access to the latest technology and are learning how to work with other people. But we don't have standards for what the conditions in schools. And that's the real problem. We allow kids to go to schools in this country where they don't have access to textbooks, where there are 35 or 40 kids in a classroom, where the person teaching them has not been trained properly. We have no standards. Not a single state in the country has adopted standards for the conditions of schools.
And do those conditions tend to be worse in areas where poor kids are going to school?
Absolutely.
Is there a racial component as well?
Well, there's a race and a class component. It tends to be that we concentrate poor kids of color in the worst schools. I was at the second largest middle school in Los Angeles, a school with about 4,700 kids. And I was just trying to understand what it's like to run a school like this. And the principal, I asked him, how do you test that many kids at once? And the principal looked at me and he said, well, it's funny you should ask. He said, we're about to give the test recently. And I asked my teachers if they could identify kids who couldn't take the test because they couldn't see it. And I said, what do you mean by they couldn't see it? He said, well, we literally had some kids whose eyesight was so poor, they could not see the paper in front of them. And those are the kind of conditions. That was a school where the average class size was about 40 kids in a classroom. Some classrooms literally had not enough desks for kids.
So the school then has to worry about trying to get eyeglasses for kids.
And they shouldn't. We're really asking too much for schools. And this is, you know, a point that I tried to make recently with a group of policy advocates. We have an article in the Times today calling for a bolder approach to education reform. And the point is that you can't really expect schools to solve all of these problems by themselves. We need national health care. We need preschool for all children. We need to make sure that the basic needs of kids are being met.
My guest is Pedro A. Noguera. His book, The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race, Equity, and the Future of Public Education, and that subtitle, The Trouble with Black Boys. Often when race comes into the conversation, there are real problems. I remember in Washington some years back, a teacher wrote about the problems of black kids giving high achievers a hard time, saying that they were essentially white. And it caused such a ruckus that the guy was fired.
Mm. Well, you know, we don't know how to talk about these issues very carefully or very in ways that really are enlightening. And so I try to address these issues directly. I don't think we are helping ourselves when we ignore the problems. But I try to do it in a way that doesn't let either doesn't blame any and set someone up, but also doesn't let anybody off the hook.
Well, how do we emphasize academics in schools that are more concerned about order, control, and maintaining a safe environment?
I'll just go back to the school I described earlier, PS 188. It's an orderly school. It's a safe school. But it's not orderly because they have guards everywhere. They don't even have metal detectors at the school. It's orderly because the kids are being well served, because they're being taught and they're engaged. It's orderly because the kids have a real clear sense of purpose.
You mean there are no kids who are acting out in class or kids who are just wandering the halls?
Sure, there are kids who challenge teachers. Kids, you know, you're addressing the needs of kids who have real problems at home. So they do act out occasionally, but when you have social workers on site as they do, when you have the ability to refer them to mental health experts if they need that, then it takes the burden off the teacher, and the teacher can focus on teaching.
We got a call from a listener, Jennifer from Maplewood, New Jersey, who's a middle school teacher, and she says it's hard because kids come to school with such low expectations.
I think there's low expectations all around. You know, the president liked to say that we're suffering from the soft bigotry of low expectations. That was one of Bush's early quotes. And I think that it's true. The kids often have low expectations. But when you get to go to schools where kids are pushed and encouraged and challenged and stimulated, you can see kids really exceed your expectations and do extraordinary things.
But a lot of schools are complaining that the No Child Left Behind, talking about President Bush, the No Child Left Behind standards are having a negative effect on schools where discipline issues are a major concern, because they don't achieve, they don't maintain the standards they're supposed to, and actually they wind up losing funding and they just sink deeper and deeper into despair.
Well, it's one of the problems with the law. The law, you know, calls for higher achievement. We use test scores as the only measure of achievement. And what we are seeing now is there are a number of high-performing, high-poverty schools across the country. And what you generally see in these schools is they don't focus just on the test. They focus on creating that enriched learning environment for kids. They focus on getting kids motivated and engaged. And then guess what? The test scores go up too. So if you can get the kids to want to read and to want to write, then they have little problem with the test.
Now, I said before, your subtitle or the title of the book is, in fact, The Trouble with Black Boys. If kids are having basic problems, health problems, eyesight problems and the like, why is it a bigger problem with boys than with girls?
Well, we're seeing this across the country, that boys are overrepresented amongst the kids who get in trouble in school, the kids who are in special education, the kids who are failing academically and dropping out. And that's particularly true amongst minority boys, black and Hispanic boys. And so what I'm trying to do is draw attention, because we know there's a real correlation, a strong correspondence between what happens in school and then what happens outside of school when they become adults. And so the real issue is, how do we create schools that can intervene early, that can prevent that pipeline to prison, and that can give kids a new sense of hope and possibility? And part of what we have to do is to come to realize that the signs of trouble appear early for kids, and we can do so much more if we can provide the support kids need when they are still small.
Did you watch the fourth season of the HBO series The Wire, where some of the same issues were dealt with? The argument in the show was that by eighth grade, these kids already have no chance, and that schools just simply train them for the streets.
You know,
or is that just a Baltimore problem?
No, that's certainly a national problem. But I also don't take the view that I've seen adults who've been incarcerated who've turned their lives around. So I'm not willing to write anybody off. I do think, though, that we make a big mistake by not investing much more in preschool and early childhood education, because it would make a difference.
Well, why does society accept the fact that an overwhelming number of black males drop out of school?
Well, that's,
I have to recognize that that's going to cause a lot of problems.
I think if the underlying assumption too often is that the problem is the boys, the problem is them and their families. And if you see it that way, then you say, well, what more can we do than to lock them up to keep the rest of us safe? If, however, you see it, well, the problem is that we put them in environments where they don't have a chance to grow and develop and to become productive individuals, then you say, well, maybe we need to focus on changing that environment. And what I'm trying to show is that you can really change outcomes simply by putting kids in an environment where they get the support they need early.
I saw a documentary about a nearly all-black school in Baltimore recently. The only parents who showed up on parent-teacher night were the ones whose kids were doing well. And that is a major part of the problem, isn't it? That without the input of the parents, you're not going to get these kids to perform well.
It's a huge problem, because parents make such a difference with their children.
Well, how do you get to the parents? Because the school really had a lot of committed people. The principal was obviously committed. The teachers cared. And they did work with the kids who were open to being worked with. But they just seem to be overwhelmed.
Yeah. There's no easy answers to that. There are too many people out there who had kids that shouldn't have had them, who are not responsible as parents. But there are also large numbers of parents who would like to see their kids succeed, but just don't know what their job is, what they should do. And what I've seen is schools that can be very explicit with parents, can build partnerships, can get them to play a more supportive role with their own children. But I don't want to pretend it's easy. All you have to do is work in the schools and try to do some of this work reaching out to parents, and you realize it's very tough, in part because you have a lot of parents who are struggling themselves. They're working long hours, they're not around, and their kids are unsupervised for too long.
My guest is Pedro A. Noguera, who is a professor at the Steinhardt School of Education at NYU. His book, The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race Equity and the Future of Public Education, published by Basic Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Pedro A. Noguera. His book, The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race Equity and the Future of Public Education, published by Basic Books. Now, we've been talking about boys, but Pregnancy, teen pregnancy is an issue as well. And a lot of girls drop out of school because they become pregnant. How do the schools deal with that? Some schools will accept them. Others throw them out the minute they start showing signs of pregnancy.
Well, you know, I have a good friend, Kristen Luca, has been doing research on teen pregnancy for a number of years. And one of the things she finds is that when you compare middle-class girls to poor girls, and you ask, well, why is it that middle-class girls have fewer babies? What you find is that the answer is not because of sex. Middle-class girls are having sex, too. The difference is college. If you think you're going to college, you think having a baby at 15 is a bad idea. That is, your future aspirations really do have great bearing on the decisions you make, particularly as an adolescent. And so if we really wanted to help girls to not have babies as teenagers, we'd need to invest much more early on in helping them think about their futures and plan so that they would not see having a baby as a rational thing to do. But again, it's counterintuitive. People go in and they want to do teen pregnancy prevention programs when the best teen pregnancy prevention is focusing on higher education or future plans for where you're going.
You include any number of studies in this book about race and education. What about the one that contrasts the performances of Mexican and African American students in Oakland?
Yeah, one of the things we've been finding, and my colleagues at NYU, Marcelo and Carola Suarez Orozco have been looking at this too, is that very often immigrant kids come with an attitude and a hope and expectation that's different from kids who were born here. They have a greater sense of the possibilities. And therefore, once they learn English, they often will do extremely well in school. And we saw that in Oakland, and I see that in many other schools throughout the country. And there, it's always a question of whether or not we've created the supports so those kids get that chance to learn. One of the things we found at the schools in Oakland was that the kids, particularly the African-American and Hispanic kids, were in a lot of conflict. And that's true in Los Angeles as well. And the conflicts really had a lot to do with what was going on outside of school, and the schools were not well prepared to help address that, to build community.
But you also discovered that when those Mexican immigrants reached adolescence, when they got a little older, they fell back.
Right. And that's, I think, one of the real sad things is as they become more American, they adopt American attitudes and American ways of seeing things. And that's often having an effect of that work ethic that you see early on can sometimes become eroded.
What happened when your son reached adolescence?
Well, I write about my own son. He doesn't like it so much, though he's learned to appreciate it. He's a teacher now, so things turn out fine for him. But my son was a great student. He was an athlete, a musician. And then he hit about 10th grade, and suddenly things changed. And he stopped doing so well in school. And
Peer pressure?
Well, it had a lot to do with peer pressure. And I noticed a change in his attitude. He seemed to be angry a lot, and I couldn't quite understand it. And he and his mother got into a lot of conflict at that time. And the more I spent time with him, because it's easy when a kid gets into that space to kind of push them away because they don't want you around anyway, I decided I was going to really spend time with him. The more I started to realize it had a lot to do with who he was hanging out with. His friends were doing much less well than he was, and that's who he identified with. But secondly, it had a lot to do with the fact that on the streets where we lived, he had to be tough to be out there. Otherwise, he'd be victimized. And what we had to try to help him realize is that even if you need to put on a tough face when you go out on the street, you don't need to keep that tough face on when you get home or when you're in school, and it's possible. And this is, I think, a hard thing that a lot of people who are white middle class don't realize, that kids who are not white in middle class have to learn to become bicultural. They have to learn how to function in more than one world. They have to learn, when do I need to speak standard English? When do I need to pull up my pants? And when is it okay and probably more appropriate to speak in the language of my friends? And that's a great deal of social pressure kids are under. And it's not every kid can navigate it.
Well, can schools, if parents don't play a role in this, you were an involved parent. But if parents don't play a role, can schools somehow undermine all of the negative aspects of peer pressure? A smart kid who just wants to be accepted by the other kids who may be just as smart, but who have absolutely no motivation to learn?
They can, because I see it all the time. I work with KIPP schools. KIPP schools have a national reputation of being very successful with urban kids. I was at a school in the Bronx, the Urban Assembly Academy for History and Culture, an all-male school. And those kids are doing extremely well. They've created this very supportive environment for them. All the students there are African-American, Hispanic males that are going to college. And that the teachers there really have gone out of their way to mentor and to support these young men, to help them see that you don't have to choose between being smart or being black, that you can be both. And, you know, when you see that happen, you know it can be done elsewhere, too.
You can write into our comments line on our show page at WNYC.org if you have any things you want to add to this discussion. WNYC.org. My guest is Pedro A. Noguera, N-O-G-U-E-R-A. His book, The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race, Equity, and the Future of Public Education, published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What do you think about the Teach for America program?
I support Teach for America. I think it's a good thing to recruit talented young college students to become teachers. My only regret, my only criticism of Teach for America is that we don't get them long enough. Usually they stay 2 or 3 years. By the time they finally get good at what they do, they head off to some other career or back to grad school. So I don't think it's a solution to the problem we have with respect to the shortage of talented teachers, but it's certainly, I think, a step in the right direction.
Don't a lot of teachers, whether they're in Teach for America or they're old veterans, find it discouraging to try to get kids who don't seem to be interested in learning to get involved?
It's hard. You know, listen, as a parent, I have 4 kids, and it's not easy to get a kid to do something that they choose not to do, whether it be read a book or do a math problem. But again, the best teachers know how to motivate kids. They know how to build connections with kids and how to make it relevant for kids. We need to learn more from those teachers. Those teachers are out there in our schools, and they're succeeding with kids sometimes who come to them who have already turned off to learning because they've come to hate school and hate anything having to do with using their brain for too long.
Don't the good teachers wind up in the better schools, the so-called better schools?
Sometimes, not always. I see some of the extraordinary teachers working in high-need schools, people who are really dedicated, who are smart and committed, and have a passion for teaching. So fortunately, that's not always the case.
What is your feeling about electing local school boards? On the one hand, it does mean that you get more parent involvement, at least in theory. On the other hand, it's led to some pretty bad districts.
It has. And I was actually an elected board member in Berkeley, California. I served as the president of the board. And I'll say from my own experience that, you know, school boards can sometimes meddle and make the job of running the schools much more difficult. At the same time, having lived now in New York under mayoral control for the last few years, where we have no checks and balances on the system, I think that's a real problem. I don't think 2 men, the mayor and the chancellor, should be allowed to, on their own, decide the fate of over 1 million children in New York City. You look at this budget, there should be some other body that they need to present that budget to for debate and deliberation and hope for some compromise. It shouldn't be allowed to, this is almost a dictatorship with respect to how schools in New York City are being managed at this time.
I remember a study many years ago in which they told teachers that kids had different IQs, or the same kid. And when the teachers were told that the kid had a higher IQ, the kid tended to do better in the class than if the teacher had lower expectations. And a listener wonders if highlighting black boys actually creates more of a problem for them. We tell them that they're failing the most, and therefore they fulfill that.
Well, I think that the caller or the person who just wrote in is making a very good point, and that's not my intention. In fact, I would argue that one of the biggest obstacles to helping all kids to achieve are the stereotypes in our society that tell them otherwise, that tell black males, for example, you have a better chance of being a ball player or a rapper than being a scientist or a pharmacist or something. So I think you're right that we do need to create schools where we can treat them as individuals and free them from the baggage related to race and gender and all the assumptions that come with it. But I don't think you do that just by ignoring it. I think we have to be, to also understand the reality out there of what these kids face and why it is that so often these kids are not succeeding in school.
Beyond being a ball player or a rapper, what about President of the United States? If Barack Obama were elected the first black president of the U.S., do you think that might do something to help improve the situation?
I think so. I don't think it's going to be dramatic and, you know, and all of a sudden everything changes. But I think, because I talked to young people already, and they're seeing it. And one of the things that is so impressive about Barack Obama is that he doesn't allow his race to be a limitation. He is very clear that he wants to be judged as an individual. And I think that sends a very strong message to young people that, that race need not serve as a way to limit them and pigeonhole what they can be. And I think that's very inspiring.
It seems to me that the biggest problem in dealing with these issues is that it is a huge challenge. And somehow you have to remain hopeful.
You do. And I always say that I remain hopeful despite my awareness of how grave the problems are, largely because I spend time in schools. And when you talk to kids who are so resilient despite the hardships they face, when you see teachers who remain dedicated and committed despite the difficult work conditions they're under, that's a reason for hope. And you get to occasionally go to a school like PS 188 and see it all come together and know it can be done.
So if you were in charge, the mayor and the school chancellor would not have such total control of the educational system. But what would happen if you were in Washington, if you were made given a cabinet position, would you get rid of No Child Left Behind, or do you see some other kind of an approach that we might try based on the studies that you've put into this book?
Yeah, I think this bolder approach that we described today in the New York Times is the
beginning. That's an ad that's in the first section of the New York Times.
That's right. And, I mean, it's interesting because every time we do these international comparisons with other countries and we see how well our kids are doing in comparison, our kids are always far behind, but we never ask why. What are those countries doing that we're not doing? Why are the Canadians doing so much better? And part of it is because it's not all on the schools. They have health care in Canada. They have preschool in Canada. They have parental leave in Canada and in Norway and in Sweden. And we have to say, why aren't our kids getting that kind of support? Why aren't our families getting that kind of support? Because we can't expect schools to solve all of these problems by themselves. And that's a big part of the reason why we continue to see such pervasive failure.
So you're saying, well, we had lunch programs and things of that sort to overcome some of these problems. But that's not enough?
Not enough. Not enough. We've got too many kids coming to school with really extreme conditions at home that make it very difficult for them to focus on learning. And it's not fair on teachers or schools to expect the schools to respond to this all by themselves.
Pedro Noguera is professor at the Steinhardt School of Education at NYU, executive director of the Metropolitan Center for Urban Education, and the co-director of the Institute for the Study of Globalization and Education in Metropolitan Settings. His book, The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race, Equity, and the Future of Public Education, it's published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard. It's been a pleasure.